This program is brought to you by Resonance 104.4 FM. If you like what you hear and want to support our work, please make a donation at fundraiser.resonance.fm.
Good afternoon, you're listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM and www.resonancefm.com on the net. And today we have a welcome return to for Bob Parks.
Hello everybody.
Good afternoon, Bob. Thank you very much for coming in. We flagged you up as having a guest witch with you today.
Can I put a message out? Sal, if you're listening, give the radio station a call. You said you'd be listening. Have you got the number here?
Have I got the number?
Yeah, she can call him.
She can call my number. Oh, 07. Oh, no, I'm not going to give that
out.
Oh, no,
don't give it.
Okay.
All right.
No, she'll find it. She'll have to find it.
Everybody.
So you were... Bob Parks, I should say, is an anti-artist or performance artist who's been on this programme many times. And at the moment, you're involved with... you're also an occult Stalinist.
Yeah, and I'm involved with... I call it The Project, which is what this is going to be about. We're just hoping to get Sal the Witch,
yes.
Sal Abruha, to help
Sal
me.
Is in King's Lynn,
yeah.
Couldn't make it down, but used to be a sergeant in the army.
Yeah, and also I've got Michelle in Brussels, who's a conceptual artist.
Hmm.
And... actually, Cody in Texas, he used to be with Gallery of Everything. He's the only person in Texas listening in. So, hi, Cody.
That was a very hip track we started with. Some sort of like a jazz from the 1960s?
1959. What it was we were in the Scouts and lived in South, and we used to go up to Soho. And this is, it's from an album called, by Rhythm and Blues label, Soho Scene, 5960, Jazz Goes Mod.
Right.
And I've just played, so there's a couple of others if there's time for it, but it's just evokes a whole, it's the affect of the time.
You're not old enough to have been there at that time.
I'm 71.
Are you?
Yeah.
Oh, you are old enough to have been
plenty
there.
Plenty old
enough.
Well,
you don't look that old, Bob.
Oh, it was, there was a coffee house called Le Macabre.
Yes.
And they had coffins instead of tables, and that was where we were made for.
Exactly.
Basically.
That was on Meard Street, or Meard Street.
You know it.
I mean,
I'll just tell you one other thing, because this is all about rhythm and blues, and that's my thing.
Yeah.
Is when we were in the Senior Scouts, we went out to Richmond, which was, the real avant garde. And on the jukebox, they had I think I played it one of the weeks, Jerry Mulligan, News from Blueport. Because I'm interested. And I won't say much about this. I love rhythm and blues, but in that time, late 50s, all you could get is modern jazz.
Hmm.
You couldn't get any blues, or certainly no rhythm and blues. So that's the route I came into it. And these laid the foundation stones for my love of the music.
Yeah. So you came in from Canvey Island?
Yeah.
Right.
Well, not there as a holiday residential, a holiday visit place when we like kids. And that's like from the Thames Delta. That's the Cockney East End is the soul of England, really. And that's where, in my my puberty, really, I experienced what I call the rhythm and blues feeling. It's like the vibes there.
Well, we should mention you are also a musician, singer.
That's right. We did a gig at the Mandrake just last Valentine's Day.
Yeah.
Sell out, actually. And this project that I'm introducing, I've got a group, Parks and the Recreationals. We do early 60s R&B.
Yeah.
And this is telling the geeks, guys in the group, is right, I've given you 5 or 10 years apprenticeship in rhythm and blues. Right now, let's do something with it. And I call this the No Name Now Collective. And I'm going to tell you what the No Name Now is. Collective. I call that the Stalinist Collective.
Stalinist?
Yeah.
Okay.
And to beef that out, there was a world premiere in Paris last month. It's called DAU, D-A-U.
Oh, yeah.
This Russian.
Hmm.
He had a town. On the outskirts of the town, he'd created a Stalinist collective, literally, for 3 years, over 300 people, where they had the whole, everything, the housing, the space was within a Stalinist collective. And
has he recreated it then?
Absolutely.
For the sake of this film project?
He's got 13 feature-length films out of it. And I saw 1.5 of them in Paris.
Hmm.
It's coming to London in April. So it's a terrific thing. It's a secret location right now. But the thing about it is, it's like a Stalinist take on it. But I think I am a Stalinist, but I think he's a bit of an anti, and he's trying to make a point. And what happens, even in this first movie, it gets gloriously subverted, and all these kind of sadomasochistic and various elements start entering in and out of this very collective system, which, I don't know, maybe that was going on out there and the Americans.
But Stalinism has a bit of a bad name, to say the least.
Absolutely. But what I've done, maybe it's played itself out politically, but I think there's still mileage in it as an aesthetic concept. And within myself, I've been a...
But wasn't he a ruthless dictator?
Yeah. And I've internalized it. At art school, we had a sociology lecturer. She said, if you're going to have a revolution, start with yourself. So for my life, I've had this ruthless dictatorial system going inside my own body.
Right.
And I've adhered to it. And it doesn't come out apparently in the way...
But you wouldn't send yourself to a labour camp?
Well, he didn't. I'm identifying with the...
I thought it wasn't at the Kulaks or something. Didn't he have? Wasn't he responsible
for
hastening the 5-year agricultural plan?
Well, in the sense I have, because I had 30 years of psychotic 25-hour murderous rages out of this over a 30-year period.
Right.
I referred to them earlier in earlier programs, which when my mum died, she took it all with her.
Took what with her?
All the murderous rages. I've had no psychotic episodes in 5 years since mum died.
Okay.
And the I'm planning for April the 3rd, 2020, for this whole project to be realised. 7 years after mum died to the day, studying with Strasberg in Hollywood, he said you have to wait 7 years for emotional memory. I don't want to do anything to start triggering off that 30 years of psychosis again. So I'm going to give it the 7 years. Now, this character, No Name Now, a good friend of mine who seems to be hated by everyone else, Adam Daly.
Who was a guest on this show not so long ago?
Last time I was on.
Mm.
Oh, gosh. See you in a moment. Hang on.
That's right.
Adam Daly on the show. Okay.
The others hate him, you say?
Others hate him. Anyhow, I'll just pretend that didn't happen.
I'll try not to interrupt you. Obviously,
no, it's
it spoils your train of thought, it seems. What's the problem with Adam Daly? Why is he a
problem? Well, my brother said he's an egoist and just got a very high...
But he's a writer and he's part of your project?
He's the inspiration for the project.
Oh.
What came in, when I had out of this documentary I had on 3 years ago on BBC Four, as a consequence I had a show with a gallery, the Gallery of Everything, and they're my gallery now. This is about a year or so ago. And he came to one of the performances, accompanying performances, and he was such that he seemed to be the only person listening the whole time.
Yeah.
And I had to contact him. And it turns out, anyhow, that he's written this trilogy. Now, he's a philosopher, and he's absolutely unpublishable because literally his ideas are too extreme for...
Right.
He introduced me to a writer friend who'd actually served two prison sentences for this Lord Horror book that he wrote.
Lord Horror.
And it's...
But is he self-published, Adam Daly?
He is now.
Okay.
But his first one was The Outsiders... The Outcast's Burden.
Right.
And the second one is... It's about Minotaurs. The third one is The Reigns of the Transfinite. Now, this character, just to give you roughly on the story, because it's essentially the framework of this book forms the framework of this project that I've devised, and I can explain how. The first book... It's roughly the plot is that this baby is found on the moor by this crazy woman who proceeds to bring him up. And as he gets into adolescence, he proceeds to eat the mother. And then every vestige of her is you're recoiling. So it's already, you can see why he's not publishable. And then he gets this group of acolytes.
How old is the baby when it starts to eat its mother?
He's not a baby. It's in post puberty into adolescence.
Oh, so I see. Missed that bit.
Oh, okay.
Thanks for looking.
No. He's a big boy, and he gets this group of cohorts, or however you describe them, who are equally eccentric but not as powerful as him. And they have a base center. I think it's probably around Leicester or somewhere. This is his house. And
is it really near Leicester?
I've got a feeling it is. Anyhow. Well, wherever
in,
it is.
In the story?
In the story.
Okay.
It might not be, but I don't know. Anyhow, it doesn't matter where it is, but it's somewhere in England.
Hmm.
And they're all disillusioned. They're all idealists, but extreme idealists. Adam's an anarchist. I'm a Stalinist. Now, Adam can only use I, and I can only use we. So we agree that maybe you're using I, and we can coexist. Anyhow, it's not a problem. We see ourselves at the sort of forefront of our particular disciplines, you see. And there's another person in the group, Stephen Nicolef, who was the co-founder of the punk magazine Sniffing Glue, who I met at a Blake conference. And later on this month, he's asked me to be Swedenborg against his Blake. Swedenborg is in his late years, and I'm in my... I'll be the old philosopher. He'll be the young Blake. And it's a meeting to celebrate 300 or 400 years of the birth, or 200 years, at Blake House. Anyhow, Stephen is part of the collective. And Adam looks upon him as an equal because he's a sort of poet as well, performance poet. And he's absolutely, Stephen, if you're listening, hi. Anyhow, he's a seminal figure because with Mark P. Perry, he founded through the magazine, almost the punk rock movement. He was the first one to interview the Sex Pistols. And he's gone out, you know, sort of grabbed him from somewhere out there. And he's one of the people in the collective. Anyhow, back to the plot.
How many people are in the collective?
Well, about 25 now. There's quite a few. It's spreading. And it's literally a collective. I want it to be everybody has equal.
What is it that binds? What is the common interest of the collective?
It's me, yeah. It's my project. But
for other people to be drawn in, what is it they're being attracted to?
Yeah. Well, just let me say a bit more about the me thing. The me thing is that, for example, in Russia in the 60s, 70s, I had a friend who was had gone from Russia to Los Angeles. She was a doctor or something. And she was saying that there, a dustman and a doctor, they get equal pay. One has it because they fulfill their needs through their job, basically. They don't need extra money. So this idea of equality is, maybe it's all my idea and everything, but I'd have no more say than anybody else in the collective. We're all component parts equal. That, you know, like either dustman is no less vital contributor to society than the doctor. That we're all doing the best that we can, and this is the ideal behind it. This is what I'm adhering to. So that it's in that sense that I'm proceeding with the collective, and that's so everyone is on the basis that they're treated equally as far as you can do it. It's just an experiment, basically. I don't know. Who knows where it's going to go? But I want to literally stick to that. Now, there's this. Oh, yeah, I didn't quite describe the plot. Then, after that, he and his acolytes sort of proceed to decimate England, go through West London, and into the universe. And the second volume is they transfigure into what are those horse centaurs, minotaurs?
No, minotaurs are bull, half bull.
It must be the Minotaur then. I can't remember. Right. Anyhow, it's this character that they all become. I think it's half. What's
Centaur is a horse.
I've forgotten. Anyhow, anyhow, this is a sort of mythological character that's comparable to this character that is
the cannibal.
No, yeah, the cannibal. So it's sort of mythological equivalent. And then in the third part, they go into the multiverse and. No name now. The conception behind it is a figure bigger than God. He sort of goes into the multiverse, and there are. It's like a modern day Gulliver's Travels. It's a social satire. And there are two parts to it. One is an ideal utopia where all these frustrated characters, they've gone bitter because their idealism has proved impossible. But they've got the perfect opportunity. So within that, they're living in this equitable society that works, functions perfectly like an anarchic society. And then the other part, too, is a dystopian, Thatcher's England. So these are parallel universes that he presents as coexisting. And over that is this figure of no name now, but he doesn't reappear. He just, I don't know, benign or whatever sort of... that's the sort of displacement. And with Adam, he's sort of been pushed into the multiverse because nobody can get on with him. They sort of label him as... I'm fine with him, but I think he's great. And he's... We share an interest in the fin de siècle, in the turn of the century, last symbolists, the French, well, Belgium even more. And I'm developing an increase in interest in the Russian symbolist movement. Anyhow, just briefly, that was, it was that which happened between the Impressionists and the Post-Impressionists. So the Impressionists discovered colour as a thing, and everything has colour, so paint everything. That was their creation. And then the symbolist, in a sense, any thought goes, you see. So they opened up in the same way that the Impressionists opened up everything to see. They opened up everything to think. And the combination of the two created Cezanne, particularly, who combined the two, and his art, Collingwood refers to it, he was directly addressing brain processes, so he wasn't sort of necessarily visually. So his work, I suppose, almost through, I've forgotten the word for it. Anyhow, when you see something and it's an illusion, but it's a real illusion, I forget what it's called now.
Hallucination.
Hallucination, yeah. Mm-hmm. He works, I've had that experience in front of Cezanne paintings, so it's a component part. It's an interesting. So that's the direction I've set the thing.
That's interesting because I would have thought when you mentioned symbolists, I put in mind of people like Odilon Redon.
Yeah.
And who's the one? I can't think of it. I can't think of the name now. The other one, who sort of beginning with M, what's that?
Yeah, he's the one. He's our main man. Gustave Moreau.
Moreau, thank you.
Who was Matisse's tutor.
But Cézanne is surely like leads to cubism, doesn't it?
Absolutely. And this is the point that Moreau, Redon, Less, but the other one is Félicien Rop.
Oh, yeah.
The Belgian. I went to the museum of his. It's south of Brussels, and it's terrific. There's this wonderful thing of this witch deflowering herself. And Sal was saying, as a witch, the idea of the broomstick being used as a deflowering device with a drug on it was actually, this is the idea of taking off on the broomstick, is literally this happened. Yeah, it looked like a very perverted kind of picture, which absolutely aroused my curiosity. And I've seen the original sound of the thing, so that's a full thing. And it sort of bears out. Mm. Now, how that then links with Cezanne is that he said of Monet, he's... just an eye, but my God, what an eye. So Cezanne perceived impressionism as being limited by just seeing. And he returned to the people like Poussin. He wanted to get structure into what the impressionists had opened up through essentially the picture plane. Now, this very famous, which is also a part of the concept behind the project, is the idea of the talisman. And actually, when I went to Paris to see the Dao show, there was a show just on Seurat's talisman. It was just by one of these ones. I've got the catalogue. And this was Gauguin over the shoulder of Seurat. What colour do you see that lake in front of you? Blue. Paint it ultramarine. Those shadows, they're sort of ready. Paint them vermilion. And this little 4-inch by 6-inch square became called the talisman. Maurice Dennis said out of that before a painting is a flat surface, a nude, it's a flat surface covered in colour in a certain order. So in a sense, this was the birth of abstraction, this idea. So if the 19th century is about the narrative, i.e. a picture telling a story, the 20th century has been about the mark, and the 21st century is about the idea. So what I instructed, this is a long story, but someone I know who I worked with in the 60s, early 70s, I bumped into him at a gay exhibition, and he said, I'm Jill's brother, who was one of the first, was a girlfriend I had. And he had been to St. Martin's subsequently, and he'd sort of carried on painting. I hadn't, I'd gone into performance art, sort of spread out. And he was kind of like what I would have been had I stayed just with painting. I was at Chelsea School of Art and I could have got into painting, but I went in another direction. Anyhow, I've commissioned him as a part of the steering group for this project to paint a talisman, but a 21st century version. So where Gauguin instructed Seurat to paint what you see, I'm telling John to paint what he thinks. Mm-hmm. So what you think actually underpins what you see.
What do you mean by talisman?
Talisman is, there's a Coleridge term, and I can't remember what it is. Anyhow, it's a word in a poem that contains the understanding of the whole poem. It releases the meaning. So the talisman is the mystical element that if you understand it, then you understand everything is about in that movement. So it's the key to the door of understanding, sort of thing. And not just that, But I've got another friend in the village who's a sculptress, and she was a good friend of Alan Davy. You know, for me, Alan Davy, of all the British artists, is the only one who had the power of the American abstract expressionist, his early stuff. I can't think of anyone else, so I highly regard him as a painter. And then he went into very much sort of mystical painting, which is equally powerful. Anyhow, this is, what's her name? Nikki. And she's got her living through medallions. She makes medallions. And I'm commissioning her. I'm not going to give her any money. It's just as an inspiration. Yeah, yeah. I've got to create this performance art, this character, no name now. I'm going to come on to describing that. But what this is the performative element of the project. There's two sides. There's a constant and a variable. The constant is a show, i.e. it's 15 encaustic 5-foot square paintings I've already completed. What's his name? The guy in Belgium, anyhow. He's a conceptual artist.
What, Brotes? You existing, but when are we talking about now?
This is the guy, what's his name? Michel.
Oh, okay. Oh, I see. One of your
I made this contact through, actually, Adam had told me to go out because Charlemagne Palestine, who developed drone music, it was Philip Glass in the 60s in New York, is living there, and he had an opening, and I went to that. He was a bit drunk. But I made the contact with Michel, and anyhow, potentially I want to get Constant Charlemagne to compose something for the Constant side of the thing. I'll come back to that anyhow. The thing with the performance is why I want to stay in touch with Adam is when I said I wanted to create a performance, he was knocked out. Yeah, someone's going to eat people, just like he's going to get into character. And I thought, no, I'm not going to start eating people as method acting training, you see. So I thought, symbolically, I think, compare performance art with acting, per se. Acting, you've just got your body as an instrument. But there's a broader base. One aspect of performance, how it uses the body, is literalism. It's got policy, so literally how your body moves. But as a supplement to that, there's the whole back mainstream art, it's all with pointing and everything. So not only can I use my persona, i.e. myself, I can use art backup. So I'm using fine art. So between the sensory work of Strasbourg's method acting and the literalism, i.e. the body of history of Western painting, I can build up a stronger thing. I've got a chance of recreating this bigger than God character. So that's my kind of plan, to combine the two elements. And
in what way, how is the character bigger than God?
That's what I'm trying to discover. Well, why Adam creates this character, eating everybody and sort of, it's like, just I suppose an analogy could be the Indian Hindu thing that you need destruction before you get creation, i.e. destroy in order to create. And then similarly, the idea of infinity came from Indian mathematics. The symbol is a Hindu symbol. So this concept of infinity, this idea of you've got to destroy in order to, first you destroy, then you put something in its place. This is the sort of the Hindu thing. And in that sense, this character, No, it's totally nihilistic. So it's destroying everything and then reinstating itself, which is bigger than God, because God is the high point of Western civilization, or the concept of God, certainly in the history of religion. So he's just destroying everything, not just to destroy it. And out of that, he can then philosophically introduce something that's bigger in his mind. It's an experiment. It's a thought experiment, if you like, which is, I think, why he's having a problem to sell his plot, you see. But I've taken it on board. But the implications of it, that I've got to live out this thing. He said, goody, someone's going to be stupid enough to actually... Because performance art, as you know, has this history of self-mutilation, the guy who had himself shot in the arm, and so on. And
Chris Burden.
And then Schwarzkopfler, who actually was supposedly cut his...
That's apparently a bit of a myth.
It is. But Gustav Metzger told me it was a myth. But he did commit suicide jumping through the gallery window after that was okay. So it's quite legitimate. But, or not legitimate. But the thing was about this, I was, when I went to LA, John, who he's the one who, what was the thing? He took my, I did an epileptic fit for my diploma in the 70s, early, late 60s, and nobody could make a head or tail of it. John took that. This is an artist that I was introduced through, Barbara Smith, who worked with Chris Burden. There were three of them, her, him, and someone else. Anyway, she introduced me to John. And John took that, and then he went on to buy a dead woman and have sex with her and then get hounded out of America and had a vasectomy as performance art. Anyway, you can see how...
What's his name?
John Duncan.
Oh.
He's at Bologna University and I'm in touch with him. He's in the movie, actually. He said how I freaked out the scary people, you see. So these people, and then Paul McCarthy was also on the scene. He thought he wouldn't join my big nose group because he thought I was, I was naive. In fact, I was innocent, and as Paul couldn't see that. But Paul now, because he's made millions out of his art, is funding. His art isn't that good, but what the money he's providing is, for example, John had a radio program like this, a close radio, and I did, this is KGFJ, the educational program in Los Angeles in the 70s, and I did... it was three elements. I got the gospel church in, Superintendent White and everyone, for a third of the program. Then I did my screaming song, and then I got a jazz trio in. So it was three elements in, in the thing. It was quite unlike anything they'd had on the program before. So that this using radio, as we're doing now, is precedented in the thing. But anyhow, because at this point, Paul McCarthy, Chris Burnett were trying then to tie their thing down so they could make money from it, conceptualize it. I was all the time, not intentionally, but my style is I'm pushing everything back all the time, opening things up. So when they were closing things down, I was opening them up even further. And this was a threat to their thing. So what I was doing, and it later evolved in my performance art into not only just physical harm, mental harm. I was literally using my mental state to experiment with, which is extremely dangerous in psychosis. So it's, in a way, more dangerous than... it wasn't intentional, it's just I happened to go that way. But I see it also, you know, sort of the plot that's laid out, and I've come out the other side of it alive. But if you're messing around with psychosis, that's extremely dangerous because you can end up round the bend. I mean, you know, with a no... It's a, even more than cutting an arm off or something like that.
Can you explain a little bit how you went through the psychosis?
Or yes, of course. I can say that. It's, again, it's art theory, but it's also something else, which it's to do with Kierkegaard. Not that it was directly from Kierkegaard, but the idea, Courbet coined the term the inner voice in sort of mid-19th century. And he said, if ever I've strayed such an inch from my inner voice, let me be struck dead on the spot. And we all took that idea. So, and then Moreau took it. He said, what is infinitesimally real is what is within. What is external to me is superficial. So he then validated the inner world as opposed to the external world and gave it precedence over that. And that was you know, laid the basis. Anyhow, for the I've forgotten what I'm talking about.
Well, I was asking you about the psychosis element.
So here we go now into contemporary art. You've got someone like Damien Hirst.
But how did you personally? You became psychotic, or did you?
Oh, how that happened was it was. I was at home and coming back from Los Angeles. I started to talk to my mum about process. Because another way of defining Los Angeles, and I call it a psychogeographical rhythm and blues sound space, and this directly links to the project, which I'll bring it in. It's dynamically introduced. How I link that in, a psychosis was, I started talking to Mum about what process was. I didn't even know the word at that time, but I said, just imagine you going into Southampton to a sale, and instead of going into the first shop you see, sit down on the bench somewhere and write out all the different shots, which is the best one, and go to the best one. It's thinking about thinking. And she said, well, I can do it when you say it, but I can't do it by myself. And the more I tried to explain her and give her the understanding, the more she'd freeze. And the more she froze, the more angry I'd get. So it polarized, and I became psychotic, violent, but not physically, because I'm a pacifist. But I'd tell her swear words at her, anything you can imagine. And even punching myself and things like that. It became very extreme. But
as a result of her being unable to carry out what you were asking her to do.
Yeah. And it was what was described as a symbiotic relationship I developed. It was a one-way thing. What happened before that, I applied my method acting to, I did a portrait of my mum and dad, and I became them both, because you do, you get into the character. And I suppose my dad didn't really want me to become him too much. So I became my mum, really. And I did not become my mum, and it sort of stuck. And it was a development of that, which it's just, she wasn't becoming me or anything like that. But I was using all the Stanislavski techniques, working with my autonomic nervous system.
But were you were trying to become your mother?
Mm. That's a technique in method acting. You, for example, you look at a painting.
Hmm. But that's normally to carry out a role, isn't it?
Yeah.
You would rehearse something to take on the role or a character.
Yeah.
But why were you trying to become your mother?
Well, because I'd combine my literalism, Pollock's literalism, with Stanislavski's sensory work. Now, the sensory work is just within the play. But literalism is life itself. Pollock said, a tree just grows. Why can't we be like a tree? So literally, everything we do is art, the way we walk. So it extended beyond the canvas, i.e. from the brain to the fingertip. Up to that point, it had been the fingertip to the mark on the canvas. But in my case, it was the bit that was inside there. So it was my body, literally. And I worked with that. I won't go into that, but I can also describe how that evolved. But it did. And I came to that point, and coming back to Courbet, anyhow, this idea of the inner voice. In contemporary art, Damien Hirst, someone like that, has gone into outside of art, i.e. into science. And he's got, what is it, the pharmacy. Hmm. So he's gone, that I've gone into, actually, in the case of mental illness. So I've used my mental illness as a canvas. Kandinsky said, I have a feeling, put it on the canvas, someone sees the canvas, they get a feeling. The canvas is the thing. Substitute in performance art consciousness for the canvas. So instead of working on a canvas, I'm working on a thought in my head. So that then becomes, so that's located in me. Mm. So that becomes the canvas that I'm working on. And that was a sort of starting point. And that's the sort of the terrain. That's the sort of description of what I then became. But to bring that back to the project, this idea, they're very sort of frameworks. It's worked out that the plot of this book, The Reigns of the Transfinite, calculus being that which has sent mathematicians around the bend over the century. Notwithstanding that, I found this conceptual artist who's used it as the basis of his conceptual art. And his pieces address directly transfinite calculus. So this is his role within it. Now, this construct that I mentioned, i.e. living in Los Angeles or Hollywood for 10 years, I gave what characterized it as a rhythm and blues psychogeographical sound space. Again, this works against the model. So let's take rhythm and blues. Rhythm and blues is my starting point. And I draw an analogy by saying, what this character, No Name Now, was, is a reaction of a philosophical brain to the mess of life. Just destroy it all. That's like one reaction to the thing. So it's the reaction of rhythm and blues, essentially a black cultural thing, which is life's really bad. But instead of portraying the bad, I'll have a party on top of it. So it's good time music in suffering, basically. It's uptown. It's like smart and, you know, posh and all that kind of stuff. Mm. So it's not like blues, Toothless Old Men. It's really sharp and snappy. Mm. So it's got this edge. That's why I went to LA and I met Johnny Otis, who coined the term rhythm and blues in the late 40s. Mm. And it came out of Texas blues. Mississippi blues. There's Mississippi blues. The deep blues went up to Chicago with the Howlin' Wolf of Chicago. Florida blues went up to New York, Gary Davis. And Texas blues went out to L.A., well, to San Francisco, and then spread down. Anyway, San Francisco is from Los Angeles anyhow. And it came out of basically the swing bands in the 40s. It didn't come from New Orleans at all. And that's the contrary to the guy, Atlantic Records, also argues the case for New Orleans. But Johnny Otis has got the greater case. And it's good time music out of the Jimmy Lunceford and all those sort of people, Count Basie. Oh, yeah. It's that area that Kansas City blues, you know, which is all Texas influence. So it's the Texas blues, which then morphed into the rhythm and blues thing on the West Coast. Anyhow, the second point is this thing of psychogeography. So psycho is the soul, basically, psychotherapy or psychoanalysis. So here we go, the soul of geography. This is, I've been a member of it's ley lines and all the phenomenon, the psychic phenomenon that pre-Christian, the Celtic and so on, Druidic societies recognize, which brings Salin and all those sort of the witch and
Sal being the witch who the witch. Might have been here today, yeah. But she couldn't make it
unfortunately. Mm. So
this group you've kind of come together somehow by coincidence, chance.
No, I brought everyone together.
Do you invite them?
Yeah, I've got a quality in my personality that allows me to work with a diverse amount of people and encourage them and keep the enthusiasm. So Ken, my tutor, this is the psychogeographical aspect. He's a pre-de Rome. He was a tutor at Leicester College of Art. And he's pre-de Rome, and as I said, but he's also produced these pantheistic bronzes. So it's the Rutland countryside with the hedgerows, the churches, the clouds, Samuel Palmer, that kind of romantic thing. He's got these little bronzes that lyrically speak of these worlds. And in that sense, he represents a psychogeographical element within the concept of this project. The third element is a Mark, whatever his name, the guy in Brussels, transfinite calculus, i.e. this is the sound space. So the sound space is linked with mathematics, it's numbers, it's things. Hopefully I can work with Charlemagne, I don't know about that. This is the concept. Now, I'm working with Gallery 46 in Whitechapel. The guy was with Subway Sect, one of the guys.
Really?
Yeah. He's what they want to be included. I haven't approached them after the initial meeting, but they want to be included in the process of the process, if you know what I mean. So that's when I get my thoughts together, that's what I'll do, i.e., it's this side, which is the performative side, my performance art character. So this is the variable. And I've got a friend, Helen Tyler, who's got a 3.5-acre garden in her back garden in Hanwell. And it's got, it's sort of shamanic. It's got the only thatched roof cottage in London. And her parents were Quakers and educational charts. And anyhow, I could use that space to sort of get a shamanic kind of presentation, the performance of this character. Now, she's kind of nervous kind of disposition, so I wouldn't imagine bringing a lot of people there. So it won't. I'm hoping to film it and then use the film as the gallery variable. So these are the two elements. We've also, in talking with Michelle this morning, we've got the idea of a triangle. Sway, where I live, Hallerton in Leicestershire, and Brussels as a triangle. So this is a psychogeographical...
Well, it's very strange because Hallerton was the next village to where I lived in Leicestershire, which was Tugby.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I think this is...
You heard
my LP, didn't you?
Yes.
And you were drawn to something in that.
And then it turned out you had been at Leicester College. But Hallerton...
Well, you didn't know that.
I used to know people that lived there.
Yeah.
And every year they have something called the Hallerton bottle kicking. Do you know about that?
Not only that, they've got Celtic, they've got Roman ruins there that have been discovered, that it's got an ancient past that makes it into a... No, I didn't know about the bottle kicking.
Yes, it's like, it's their own version of the,
What Ken did was create a hare as a sculpture, as a symbol of the rites of spring. And this hare, that Charlotte was telling me. It's a bronze. It's about this size. She wants to hold it in the next ceremony they have as a constituent part of the thing. And there's all sort of infighting within the community in Hallerton, how the propriety of doing this and all that sort of thing.
They're going to do it in Hallerton?
Yeah.
Oh, OK. Part,
so his sculpture now is going to... Ken's thing about sculpture was kind of close to Henry Moore. You know the way Henry Moore's sculptures can't exist with it? Well, they do inside galleries, but they're redolent, they're dead. What it is about them, you've got, like, for example, the King and Queen over a Scottish loch, and there's like a conversation between nature and the sculpture. It's a dynamic. So in a sense, they're not so much about the sculpture per se, but the dynamic that's created by situating something that's been created by a creative artist within that context, and how that interacts and how one explains the other. Well, Ken's sculpture's taking even that a little bit further. So it's not sculpture in a sense, literally. It's more the spirituality that underpins it.
Shall we just say that this group, this forum that you have, you meet near Tower Bridge, don't you?
Well, we've been at meeting at Vutorini's. And this is Sophie Parkinson, it's a recreation of the old Colony Club.
Right.
Because her mother was involved with the Colony Club.
Okay.
And she attended it. But anyhow, Vutorini's, she's invited me to come along, and it's kindly, she's allowed us to use it as a sort of a platform.
What is Vutorini's?
It's, a club that's, because the Colony sort of phased out in the 90s.
Yeah.
It's bringing it back to life, and there's
is this the thing that's near to Tower Bridge?
Just around the corner from there.
I see. But it's not, presumably it's not open to the public? You have to be invited or something?
Yeah, but no, for example, I did a gig there with our group, and anybody could come along, so it was on the internet. But it's a private membership club. It's like downstairs in a cellar. It's a terrific place. It's kind of surrealist, and it's a wonderful space. So I'm sort of serving. She's interested in, I think, the way because her partner said, we buy the drinks for you. You don't buy drinks, you know. They see me as a sort of an addition to the thing. And I think what it is creating a climate of creative people, and out of that will be the pool. And it's only in its formative stages. But do
they acknowledge you as the sort of linchpin of this thing?
In a way, not the whole thing, but Ken Ford was close friends with Francis Bacon in the early 50s, when he was not that close, but he thought they were friends, sort of thing. And I didn't know that at the time. Ken introduced me to Cecil Collins. And Cecil Collins and Francis Bacon were exact contemporaries. And Collins hated Bacon because he said the role of the artist is to direct people's gaze up to kind of eternal values. And he said the gutter press and everything directs people's gaze down. And Bacon epitomized that spirit. And he said April Fool's Day should be the most, and this is the show's in April. But it's not the first of April, it's the 3rd of April, because it's the Holy Fall, this idea, this image. And he wrote various books. I went to some of his classes when he was teaching at Central St. Martin's. And it's this idea of, what's the thing with Cecil Collins? It's very much a spiritual approach to art. That was, I lost the thought, I'm sorry. But anyhow, that was the link with, but Ken never told me about Francis Bacon. So it was sort of a love-hate relationship probably between them. But there's that link between it. There's a pantheism. One of the things I did was to go to find out the source of rhythm and blues. I went out to Ouidah in Benin. And that's like the Vatican of voodoo. And I had a goat sacrificed and John, who did all these freaky things, who's now somewhere in, was knocked out by what I was doing, going through a voodoo ceremony, and have brought back that kind of... Max Beauvoir is the chief voodoo priest in Port-au-Prince in Haiti, and I went to his peristyle Mariana, and I sung Stand By Me and various things like that, and after that, I went out to Ouidah a year later. But just to encapsulate it, and then I can get on to other things, he said that Haiti is waiting for the rest of the world to slow down, to catch up. So basically, voodoo is not this sticking pins in things. It's an identification with the force of the river, the force of the wind. And it's like natural forces and, working in tandem with it. So it's quite a different thing than the Hollywood presentation of it. But I just want to bring the whole structure together, if I can, because it's coherent. So we've got the variable, and I've got the constant, and I've linked this other idea to sort of pin it. And the third, oh crikey, what's the bit? Because it's another big thing. Oh, this idea of this place that these characters in the Reigns of the of this book, the trilogy, meet, is a literal place in the part one, and then the second one it becomes almost a metaphorical place that recreates itself conceptually in the universe, and then in the third one it's like a construct in somewhere in cyberspace almost. It's recreated. It's that same room, i.e., when you're working with method acting, you work sensorially to what color was the room, what the smell was. You know, you specifically work for things, and you get out of that, you get the affect. And it's the affect that you work on as an actor to recreate the role. You can't work directly for emotion. And similarly with the... what was I talking about? I'm nearly there.
I should just interrupt. You're listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM with today's guest, Bob Parks.
I've got it now.
Okay.
This house, this creation, and this cyberspace place. I live in Sway, and in the New Forest, and it used to be called Art Sway, but now it's called Spud Works. And they take this friend that my brother had when he had a nervous breakdown, Linda Fredericks, in Isleworth Hospital. This is the 60s. When I was a postman in Sway, I happened upon this council house, and Linda, the woman, had squatted, and she had established herself in a council. Anyhow, it was Linda who I knew from back then. She then went on, she was teaching at Armwood, and raised £500,000 from the National Lottery and opened Artsway, which is a local national, she's a Trotskyist and I'm a Stalinist, but anyhow, that wasn't the thing, national and an international level. And then she died of cancer, and also the funding was taken away after about 10 years. It was very successful, because it's something to do with Southampton. Anyhow, it's been superseded by Spud. It's a new initiative. And they've nearly built now. They've got 5 artist studios. And I'm bidding for one because I've never been able to afford a studio. And the force of my argument is that I want to use this as a powerhouse. Now, I've got all the work done, but everything I create in it over the coming year, and then after that will be the development of that, is to communicate visually. So I'll use digital camera scanning. So as I produce images, there'll be the directives for this network, this No Name Now collective, of directions to go in. And I increasingly want to move it over into a visual mode rather than a verbal one, because it speaks more subliminally through that. It's a greater canvas, and it's a feeling thing I'm getting there to. It sort of goes beyond words in a way, what I'm aiming for. And this idea of bigger than God is kind of a beyond words thing that I'm hoping to edge towards. I'm commissioning Nikki to do the pendant, but she then is going to talk. I'm arranging a meeting with her with Adam. And because no one else could get on this chalk, Philip, if you're listening, he's then the only handmade shoe shop for men in London on Wimpole Street. And he's also a tailor. And I'm commissioning him to make a garment for me to wear. And as they're both craftspeople, through their craft, I want Nikki to communicate to Chalk. So she's got to create this image.
Do you have any idea what the garment is like?
No. This is the point. Because the thing at art school was to work to not have preconceived ideas and to adopt a non-artistic approach to art. So here's Nikki, firstly, trying to create this image for bigger than God. I don't know. It's a vast thing. And out of that, I want her, through her artistic vision, she's having been to art school, to communicate to God, something to God, to Chalk, this idea, to instruct him how to make the tunic. So between them and their skills, this will be a visual adjunct to this like cerebral thing I'm trying to create. So I'm trying to build up all the time and feed in different sources. But just come back to this central powerhouse, the idea of Artsway, the studio space. If I'm fortunate enough to win the bid, and it'll be May, I can start producing, literally just to make the directors use this as a power in the same way. Again, it comes back to the novel.
If listeners want to sort of take more interest in this, is there anywhere they can, is there anything on the internet that you can
we're getting websites up, and to point out that this goes out to everyone, and potentially everyone can be a part of the No Name Now Collective. So it's not
the No Name Now Collective.
Yeah,
I see. And
just let me say something about No Name Now, and then there was a God, what's it? The name of God as God was a movement, a religious movement in Russia that was spurned by, I suppose, the communists and by the Russian Orthodox movement. But essentially, it was an ecstatic thing, and it was like the naming of Jesus. They name it over and over again, and if you get into an ecstatic state, you can get by renaming it. And the point was that you have to be careful, because sometimes it gets the blood flowing in the lower part of the body, which takes the monks in the completely the wrong direction, so they have to skill to move it up into the upper part, you see. And this was outlawed, but the idea of the name of God is God. It's not like the belief of God, it's like the literal name, which comes close to the mark. So it's what's happening on the canvas. It's the word in the Bible which is what you worship, you see. But that was seen as not a thing. So that's what's his name? The guy in Brussels.
Is it Michel?
Michel discovered, and he's brought that in. And so No Name Now takes it a step further, i.e. the name of God as God is God, is No Name Now. So literally not a name of God, but no name, not only no name, but No Name Now. So it comes even within that. So the construct is inside that movement. Conceptually, right. Philosophically, it's quite an interesting place to be.
Bob, wow. Thank you very much for coming in. And we
play out with Little Sister.
Well,
Ray
yes,
Bryant.
I'd like to. You know, we hope we can keep in touch and keep up to date with your forum.
Yeah.
What's the next thing? That's do you have an event coming up or something?
Yeah. Yes, I do. Check your ad up for the Mandrake Hotel in Fitzrovia. What I'm hoping for is an amended No Name Gal collective, which would be the rhythm and blues feeling group plus a whole bunch of other musicians like backing singers and that, to put on an R&B show as a contrast to this free jazz thing that we did. And that's, keep your eyes out. Sal's in the process of setting the whole thing up and getting the rehearsals scheduled.
All right, Bob, thanks very much for coming in. Thank you.
This program has been brought to you by Resonance 104.4 FM. If you liked what you heard and want to support our work, please make a donation at fundraiser.resonance.fm.